Good morning and welcome to Rising. We're kicking off the week with a fantastic edition of our show, and we're in a similar color palette.
Robbie, we're reunited after a little hiatus. We're dressed the same. What could go wrong today?
Brianna was telling me before we started talking that you think we begin the week dressed similarly and then diverge.
That's my theory. I think that we both go through more of a thought process at the beginning of the week that for some reason mirrors each other. And then as the week becomes more chaotic, it devolves and neither of us is putting very much thought into what we're wearing. But the beginning of the week, Monday, we are very much simpatico. And I think it bodes well for our coverage today.
Yeah, we'll see if our commentary follows that. Same pattern. Please take it away.
All right. Well, first up, we have some fallout from the State of the Union, the Republican response to Biden's address. Got an SNL send-up from this weekend's host, Scarlett Johansson.
Good evening, America. My name is Katie Britt, and I have the honor of serving the great people of Alabama. But tonight, I'll be auditioning for the part of Scary Mom.
Now, Britt's performance was roundly skewered for what was described as a somewhat artificial delivery style, which differs notably from how she normally sounds.
I am a proud wife and mom of two school-aged kids. My daughter, Bennett, and my son, Ridgeway, are why I ran for the Senate. I'm worried about their future and the future of children in every corner of our nation. And that's why I invited you into our home tonight. Like so many families across America, my husband Wesley and I just watched President Biden's State of the Union address from our living room. And what we saw was the performance of a permanent politician who has actually been in office for longer than I've been alive. One thing was quite clear though. President Biden just doesn't get it. He's out of touch. Under his administration, families are worse off, our communities are less safe, and our country is less secure.
Now, criticism for once was pretty bipartisan. Here's Fox News' take on Britt's address.
I want to talk about specifically one anecdote that I've heard you tell before. It is a horrific story of a sex trafficking survivor. Nobody is questioning that the story happened, that she is actually who she is, says she is, and that this happened. The question is about the timing and the implication of you telling the story. The New York Times has this. Right. None of this happened during President Biden's administration, but that didn't stop the first-term senator from strongly implying that the president could have somehow prevented it from happening, using rhetoric that seemed calibrated to inflame public fears about immigration. Did you mean to give the impression that this horrible story happened on President Biden's watch?
No, Shannon, look, I very specifically said this is what President Biden did during his first 100 days. Minutes after coming into office, he stopped all deportations, he halted construction of the border wall, and he said, I am going to give amnesty to millions. Those types of things act as a magnet to have more and more people here. I then said in his first 100 days, he had 94 executive actions, and those executive actions didn't just create the crisis, they invited it. I then contrasted it with my first 100 days. Shannon, I went to the border three times in my first 100 days in office. And when I was there, I asked for the real, unvarnished truth. I wanted to sit down. I asked the Border Patrol agents. I asked the people there. I asked the victims, previous victims of drug cartels, tell me what it's like. Tell me what we need to do. Tell me what we need to know. The truth is, and the media knows this, yet they're not covering it, that human trafficking has gone up under President Biden. If you look back under 2018, it was a $500 million industry, human trafficking by the drug cartels. It is now.
Now, former Fox News Megyn Kelly also weighed in. Let's take a listen to that.
I don't know what the F I saw. I agree with the people saying she looked like she was auditioning for a show on Lifetime. The drama, the fake affectation, the over-the-top portrayal of emotions I did not believe she was feeling at all. Her inauthenticity, it was totally cringe.
Britt was also forced to respond to some substantive criticism over a specific anecdote in her speech, as we alluded to earlier. She did reference a horrific sex trafficking incident that happened to a woman named Carla Jacinto Romero, ending the section with, "Biden's border policies are a disgrace." But in fact, those events described happened between 2004 and 2008, which was during the Bush era, and Romero was never trafficked to the United States. So,
yeah, so this was a kind of unique moment in the internet. You know, rarely is the internet so united over things as they were to this particular speech. The take seemed to be that the choice to position herself in a kitchen to talk about her role as a wife and mother, much more so than her role in government, seemed to suggest a kind of anti-feminist vibe that didn't sit well with some liberal commentators. And then there were people like Megyn Kelly and others. She wasn't alone on the right, who just seemed to find it generally cringe, regardless of whatever gender stereotyping you may or may not read into it. My feeling was that it didn't seem altogether that different than the kind of weirdness that exists in a lot of these response videos, but her getting substantive facts wrong and trying to create the perception that Biden was responsible for a pretty horrific event that this woman suffered, when it just quite simply did not happen on his watch, was the real basis of substantive criticism.
Yeah, look, it seems like it was a bad choice to single out that case of something bad that's border related that happened so long ago. And look, I agree with Megyn Kelly that the performance, I don't know that I would say it was like the worst performance I've ever watched. Yes, it was a little over the top. Being on camera is hard. There was something a little performancy about how sad and scared she sounded. I didn't mind I think the choice to, you know, frame herself as a mother and be in a kitchen are all perfectly defensible decisions. I know I saw a lot of discourse about the kitchen, or how it's a weird kitchen, or how it's, you know, it's or it's too fancy. I saw both. I saw it's too fancy. It's not fancy enough. I thought people were going a little crazy. Like, okay, it's a kitchen, whatever. Seems weird to be obsessed over it. These things don't really matter very much. So we're talking about it because it was in the news. I personally did not find the SNL thing funny at all. Maybe that's a defect I have, that I'm not capable of laughing at Saturday Night Live anymore. I adore Scarlett Johansson, but she did a fine job. It wasn't funny to me. And like, again, the audience just laughing at everything she said. I found that more off-putting, frankly, than the original speech. But
I don't know. I didn't watch all of it, but the clips I saw, the send-up seemed pretty good. The facsimile of it was pretty remarkable. They got, whatever you think about the kitchen, SNL nailed the set and the wig and the attire of Scarlett Johansson. And I was kind of impressed by how quickly they turned it around just as a feat of art.
Maybe it's because this senator Britt has not been on TV very much, is not a household name yet. We're not accustomed to seeing her face, so I wonder if people will think the Scarlett Johansson version might take hold and just be her.
Well, Robbie, now she is a household name because she's very much associated with a household, in particular, a kitchen. Let us know what you thought of both the SNL bit and the speech itself in the comments. Stick around, we have a lot more Rising coming up right after this.
What's on your radar, Brianna?
Well, Robbie, today I'm probing a question on a lot of people's minds. Is it better to build a port than confront Bibi? Is a plan for America to build a port off the question of Gaza to deliver humanitarian aid the latest Biden boondoggle? As observed in a recent Washington Post op-ed, Biden's plan to build a port in Gaza to facilitate aid deliveries has drawn considerable skepticism and even ridicule. First, although more than a quarter of Gaza's population, or about 576,000 people, are on the brink of famine, according to the United Nations, the plan to construct a temporary pier off the coast of Gaza is expected to take 2 months and may require up to 1,000 U.S. troops to construct. It's also unclear how aid delivered into Gaza by sea will be transported within Gaza to people in need, especially to the population concentrated in the southern city of Rafah, which Prime Minister Netanyahu says he plans to invade despite U.S. concerns about the humanitarian implications, and Biden saying over the weekend that invading Rafah is a red line. Meanwhile, aid workers emphasize that trucks are the most efficient and inexpensive way to deliver aid. The senior UN humanitarian and reconstruction coordinator for Gaza welcomed the pier, but stressed that air and sea is not a substitute for land. British Foreign Minister David Cameron similarly emphasized that trucks are, quote, the fastest way to get aid to those who need it in a Twitter post on Friday. Biden's policy decision highlights a disconnect between America's stated interest in providing aid and our allies' choice to block the provision of said aid, and America's choice to continue to supply weapons to that ally that are being used to cause and sustain the very humanitarian crisis we're now trying to ameliorate. The contradiction is obvious. Why is America on both sides of this humanitarian catastrophe? In a bombshell report from last week, the Washington Post revealed that Washington has approved more than 100 separate military sales to Israel since its invasion of Gaza, even as officials complain Israeli leaders have not done enough to protect civilians. Adding to the controversy, the Post reported the weapons transfers were processed without any public debate because each fell under a specific dollar amount that requires the executive branch to individually notify Congress. As former State Department official Josh Paul pointed out during a recent interview on Democracy Now, quote, it is actually illegal to provide military assistance to a country that is restricting U.S.-funded humanitarian assistance. We know that this is the case with Israel. Earlier this month, State Department spokesman John Kirby responded to a question about the contradiction between the U.S. delivering bombs and aid at the same time by echoing what has become a familiar refrain, that Israel has the right to defend itself.
The president and the vice president, and you, for that matter, have both said that the situation with getting aid into Gaza is too difficult. The vice president said that Israel needs to allow more aid in. No excuses. What is preventing the president from communicating to the Israeli government that if they don't allow aid, we will not continue supplying weapons? Why is that not a fair trade? No aid, no bombs.
Because the president still believes that it's important for Israel to have what it needs to defend itself against a still viable Hamas threat. Maybe some people have forgotten what happened on the 7th of October, but President Biden has not.
Over 30,000 Gazans have died since October 7th as a result of aerial bombardments, direct fire from Israeli troops, a lack of medical supplies, or starvation. Israel denies limiting aid into Gaza. However, prior to October 7th, 500 aid trucks entered Gaza each day. And since October 7th, the number of trucks per day has rarely exceeded 200 and is frequently less than 100, as you can see from this chart from the Washington Post. Now, Biden's choice to build a new port rather than using one of the half dozen Israel-controlled crossings into Gaza seems to suggest an effort to avoid a direct confrontation with Israeli leadership and could contribute to perceptions that Biden is a weak president. As history professor Badr El-Saif told the Washington Post, it sends a very bad signal on U.S. leadership. It reinforces what many Arabs think, that Israel is running the show and the U.S. follows. It shouldn't be an ask of Israel, he said. It should be a command, given that the U.S. is financing the war. In addition to the political implications, there are questions about the strategic legitimacy of the plan as well. The pier will take months to construct, months during which the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is predicted to deepen, even in the event of a ceasefire. MSNBC's Jonathan Capehart was able to raise this concern with Joe Biden directly in an interview over the weekend. Let's listen.
Let's talk about the temporary pier that you announced during your State of the Union address to get supplies into Gaza. It's going to take 60 days to get that constructed. What more are you doing in the absence of cooperation from Netanyahu and a bill from Congress to get supplies into Gaza, more humanitarian aid into Gaza?
Everything we can. We're pressing Israel to open up access in the north from Israel. We're also doing airdrops. I know several people were killed with the airdrop. There's a way to avoid that in the future. We're working with our Arab friends to figure out how much we can get in. Everything, look, it's a desperate situation. Food, medicine, everything needed, they're badly needed, and it's needed now.
As you heard, Biden alluded to the possibility of more airdrops. However, as Biden mentioned, the airdrops themselves have come under scrutiny after at least five Palestinians including two children, were killed when parachutes attached to the aid packages failed to open. Moreover, the lethal airdrops delivered only 36,000 meals. That's for over 2 million people. Truck capacity vastly outstrips air capacity for delivering aid, which is perhaps why Biden also alluded to the possibility of opening up road access in the north of Gaza. Note, however, that truck deliveries have not been without their problems as well. It was a truck delivery to northern Gaza that laid the basis for what has been termed the Flower Massacre that occurred on February 29th, wherein food-deprived Palestinians approaching an aid truck were fired upon by Israeli forces, resulting in the death of over 100 Gazans. Perhaps in light of that event, yesterday a journalist asked a Pentagon spokesperson whether he had received assurances from the Israelis that they would not fire upon Palestinians as they tried to retrieve foreign aid. Let's take a listen.
Have you received assurances from the Israelis that they will not fire upon Palestinians as they seek to retrieve the aid?
Look, our focus is on delivering the aid. I'm not going to speak for the Israelis.
The need for assurances is far from abstract, given corroboration by Biden yesterday that Israelis will be guarding the new port being built by the United States. Again, this raises the question of how this access point will differ from other Israel-administered access points that already exist. And the most crucial question of all, why won't Biden withhold military assistance as leverage to ensure humanitarian aid gets to the people of Gaza?
You know, I was seeing even the New York Times asking really the question you're asking here in a pretty good article about it, saying the same military, the U.S. military, that is sending the weapons and bombs that Israel is using in Gaza is now also sending food and water into the besieged territory. We have made aid, relief, et cetera, available to people in the midst of war before, but I think it's pretty unprecedented to be simultaneously contributing military resources against the side that's being attacked and then also giving aid. And, you know, frankly, I wonder if the American people, the extent they know about this, whether how they would feel about tax dollars being used to both destroy and then to destroy, starve, and kill, which you can argue, and some people argue that's necessary, and then on the other side to build, to give food, to equip, it's like it doesn't make logical sense, frankly.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of Americans would have a problem with their tax dollars being spent to dig a hole and then fill it back up.
Yeah, that's exactly a kind of analogy that I was going to mention. It feels like we're simultaneously poking in the holes in the bottom of the boat and then paying to bail it out. We are very much on both sides of this equation. And it's not only a financial question of whether this is practicable. It's a legal question because, as the former State Department official I cited pointed out, it's actually illegal to provide military assistance to a country that's restricting U.S.-funded humanitarian assistance. Hmm. So it is illegal. It is against our own laws to say we're going to continue to give military assistance when you're blocking our financial assistance. Not to mention the reality that there are trucks lined up outside of all of these checkpoints. We showed a graphic showing just how many of these Israeli-controlled checkpoints are obviously surrounding the territory of Gaza. And the logic that says, you know, Joe Biden is holding Bibi close to him, he's his ally, he literally flew to Israel after October 7th, he has committed over and over again that he is never going to stop giving aid to Israel. Even in the Jonathan Capehart interview where Capehart asks him, do you have a red line with Netanyahu? He says, yes, I have a red line, but I'm never going to, immediately, I have a red line, but I'm never going to stop giving weapons aid.
Then it's not really a red line.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's been reported both ways in the media. You know, some people who are, I think, trying to create distance between Biden and Netanyahu because the optics are so bad are saying, look, Biden is standing up to Netanyahu, has a red line. But other reporting is, I think, getting to the heart of the issue, which says, what does it mean to have a red line if you're never willing to enforce it?
Whatever Netanyahu or Israel want, no questions asked, end of story, just seems contrary to what previous presidents have done and is totally contrary, frankly, to the America First foreign policy that so many voters in both parties say that they actually want.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see how that goes over. I can't think of, I mean, it's terrible, obviously, but worst optics than the aid drop hitting and killing people. Just terrible stuff. Thank you so much, Brianna. More Rising right after this. Well, if a picture is worth a thousand words, how much is a doctored photo worth? Clearly a lot if it's of the Princess of Wales, because over the weekend, a photo was posted on her Instagram account, Kate Middleton, of her and her three children on behalf of Mother's Day in the UK. Now, it was the first sighting of any signs of the princess since she did go in for abdominal surgery in January. But sharp-eyed followers of the royal family found several places where the photo was touched up, including a mismatched zipper, the cuff on Princess Charlotte's sweater, drooping steps in the background. Now, touching up photos, nothing new for the royals, but Sunday's post was a step too far for many news agencies, including the Associated Press, Getty, and Reuters. The AP writing that, quote, the source manipulated the image in a way that did not meet the AP photo standards.
Kate took to social media on Monday, saying, like many amateur photographers, I do occasionally experiment with editing. I wanted to express my apologies for any confusion the family photograph we shared yesterday caused.
Amateur photographer?
Now, I don't know about you, Robbie.
That is not a real photo. I'm sorry if that's a conspiracy theory and I'm looking at the conversation on social media. That photo is not new. It is not a new photo of her. It is entirely edited. It is stitched together from previous images of her and the family. Sorry, that's the truth.
Yeah.
I don't know who doesn't want to hear it. That's what,
yeah.
Right? Am I wrong?
So there have been one and now maybe a second sort of murky, dark photo of Kate Middleton riding in a car that have been sightings since this January surgery. But other than that, one of the most photographed women in the world has been absolutely off the front page. Mind you, this is a woman who, like, hours after giving birth to her first child, was standing outside of the hospital in a beautiful blue dress, looking like nothing had ever happened to her a day in her life. So there were questions about why she hasn't been front and center. Then to put forward a photo, because it's Mother's Day in the UK, that was so heavily photoshopped that it's difficult to ignore. I mean, one of the children's missing a hand. Like,
yeah.
And it's just, it's in your face Photoshop. And then the apology, it seems to me, just makes it so much worse.
Yes.
Trying to play this off like I'm, what
is that? It's the cover up. It's not the conspiracy, it's the cover up.
What does being an amateur photographer have to do with Photoshopping a photo up the wazoo? Some people are drawing some similarities between her face in that photo into an old Vogue cover from some years back.
Yeah, I'm looking at this.
And then what does it mean about her condition? In a really serious way, frankly, what does it mean about her health condition or what's going on with the family that they can't even get her in a photograph with three of her kids for a quick Mother's Day post.
And I will say, it is totally fine for her to have some privacy. I don't care them. I find it, you know, the whole obsession with the royals, frankly, I don't quite understand it, to be truthful. But so she can just have her privacy as she's recovering or whatever she's going through. That's fine. But this is just a lie. This is not a new photograph of her. It was lazily stitched together. And then to try to play it off like, oh, I was just, you know, messing around on Photoshop, like I was doing the stretchy thing on Mario for the entrance to the Nintendo 64 game, is not, if anybody gets that reference, let me know in the comments. Some of you will.
All right.
There's no way.
So another aspect of this that raised eyebrows was the absence of Kate Middleton's wedding ring on her left hand ring finger, the hand that's going around her daughter. This has raised speculation that it's not just about her medical concerns, but perhaps this is a relationship rift, of course, which this family has been very familiar with.
I just don't think that's her
fashion.
Hand.
I think the most likely thing is that whoever's photoshopping this is doing a Frankenstein melange of people from all over the place, and they just forgot to photoshop a ring back on.
I'm looking at the photo again, like blown up. It looks so bad.
It's so bad. It's worth really scrutinizing every piece of this because, look, there are a lot of high-profile Photoshop oopsie daisies that happen, especially
sometimes on magazine covers.
Sometimes on magazine covers, and oftentimes when it's, you know, influencers like the Kardashians who really do a lot of their own work, or at least at a certain point in time, did do a lot of their own work and manage their own image. But another part of this that people are finding a little unbelievable is the idea that an institution like the Crown is allowing Kate Middleton as just a random
mom to select.
Edit, Photoshop, and post photos of her choosing to what is a Crown account. These are not people who are allowed to have personal social media presences, you know?
It's just obviously not true. It's obviously not true that Kate Middleton herself was doing the photoshopping on that and made it look a little too exaggerated. There's no way. So they're just, like, lying. We all know they're lying about that. There's no way they did it.
Yeah. So I do wonder what
I think
the
it makes us wonder more. You're right. It makes us wonder more, like, is she more seriously ill? Is there something going on? And again, I don't think the gossiping and the rumor mongering about the royal family is necessarily always fair to them, and it can be very prurient and very, like, none of our business. They're causing more. This is that they stepped in it themselves here.
That's 100%. It's also worth noting that I do think it's hard for me to imagine why the royal family, apart from generalized privacy concerns, obviously nobody wants their own business out in public. Mm-hmm. Lloyd Austin just went through a controversy, remember, a month or two ago because he didn't disclose that he had been in the hospital and who was running the military and defense when he was out. Okay, like, I understand that, like, on a human level, there's privacy. But I don't like this, but one of the conditions of being in the royal family is that you don't really have that kind of privacy. That's exactly why Prince Harry left, right? And he wasn't the first one. So that being said, it's curious to me why the crown wouldn't simply, if she's dealing with health struggles, I think we understand that. She's not the first royal to have a long-term health concern.
And King why Charles has a health concern right now.
Why they couldn't just say that and be like, look, she needs her privacy. She's convalescing. Please leave her alone. But the fact that they haven't done that has led some folks on the internet to entertain some wild speculations that it's a kind of health concern that is a little less flattering, like plastic surgery. Black Twitter has been making a lot of jokes, which are just jokes and shouldn't be credited, about her having a BBL, which is the butt implant. I mean, but that's, those kind of jokes are being generated. Because what other excuse could there be for not just disclosing
my favorite
having trouble?
Joke I'm seeing is somebody shared the scene from the first Toy Story movie where Woody and Buzz are prisoners of the evil kid who lives across the street, mm-hmm. and Woody's trying to tell the friendly toys that everything's fine, and he just has Buzz's arm. And you remember that scene where he's trying to be like, hey, look, we're friends, and he's doing the shake off screen, and then he accidentally pulls just the arm, and one of the other toys, like, vomits.
it's like making it look worse than it is because of your choice to cut someone up literally or figuratively in Photoshop and present that into the world. We'll definitely give you follow-ups as we learn more about what is actually going on with the royal family and Kate Middleton specifically. Stick around. We have more Rising for you.
And more amateur photography.
Coming up next. As you're probably aware, in President Biden's State of the Union speech last week, he referred to an undocumented immigrant as an illegal.
Lincoln Riley, an innocent young woman who was killed by an illegal. That's right. But how many of thousands of people being killed by illegals?
There was immediate backlash from his base, but in an interview given on the tarmac outside of Air Force One the next day, Biden seemed to double down, saying, quote, technically he's not supposed to be here. But pressure from within the party seemed to force an apology during a sit-down with MSNBC's Jonathan Capehart on Saturday. Let's take a listen.
During your response to her heckling of you, you used the word illegal when talking about the man who allegedly killed Lincoln Riley.
Undocumented person. And I shouldn't have used illegal. It's undocumented. And look, when I spoke about the difference between Trump and me, one of the things I talked about on the border was that the way he talks about vermin, the way he talks about these people polluting the blood. I talked about what I'm not going to do, what I won't do. I'm not going to treat any of these people with disrespect. Look, they built the country. The reason our economy is growing. We have to control the border and more orderly flow, but I don't share his view at all.
So you regret using that word?
Yes.
Now, Donald Trump weighed in on Biden's State of the Union performance over the weekend, slamming it as an angry, dark, hate-filled rant before making fun of Biden for repeatedly tripping over his words.
Two nights ago, we all heard Crooked Joe's angry, dark, hate-filled rant of a State of the Union address. Didn't it bring us together? Remember, he said, I'm going to bring the country together. I'm going to bring it together.
Trump also blamed Biden for Lake and Riley's death, saying Biden's neglect of the border was the proximate cause of her murder. He also criticized Biden for walking back the use of the term an illegal.
He's really said some bad things today, and we'll get into that. He said some really bad things. But one of the lives that was taken from us was a incredible 22-year-old nursing student right here in Georgia, Lakin Riley.
What do you make of all of this, Robbie?
I think it was a huge mistake for Biden to so carefully emphasize that he used the not PC language to refer to this murderer. I don't know who that makes happy. Does that really win back over progressives who are mad about him, everything else? It certainly alienates, I think, not just, I mean, conservatives don't like him anyway, but polls show right now major dissatisfaction with Biden's handling of the border and of immigration. Trump massively favored in polls on that issue specifically. This seems like the exact kind of thing that was, I don't know, workshopped by very out-of-touch, woke, elite media people, like the worst sort of comms people that, oh, I'm so sorry I called him illegal. It's undocumented. Who cares? It's a murderer. Like,
so a lot of people care. I think the analogy that I heard someone make was, someone can do a vicious murder and they can be black, but that doesn't mean, it doesn't say something about me if I call them the N-word, right? Or I'm black, but you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. The fact that if you believe that you shouldn't use certain language about people because it's offensive, because it's otherizing, because of their status isn't the issue. The fact that they're a murderer is the issue. The fact that someone's black isn't an issue. The fact that they're a murderer is the issue. And when you start to use certain kind of language to describe people, it starts to suggest that you are dehumanizing or trying to cast aspersions on a group that they belong to, as opposed to one individual's actions. So I hear you saying that it obviously doesn't yeah. bother you, but it is absolutely not true that Biden's base wasn't extremely upset about this. And I'm not talking about the left, who frankly is over him to begin with. I'm talking about liberals. Remember, Democrats ran against Donald Trump largely on Biden being an improvement on the what was perceived as distasteful messaging around immigrants and Latinos specifically. Ever since the beginning of his they're not sending their best kind of colloquy, regardless of whether you think that's a good argument or if you think that Donald Trump was perfectly justified in using that language, Democrats have framed themselves, both in 2020 and now, as an antidote to what they see as the kind of xenophobic ugliness that Donald Trump represents. So for Joe Biden to use identical language to that which has been criticized coming out of Donald Trump's mouth collapses the distinctions that that Biden is trying to make between him and his opponent. And that on top of all of these other points at which he's disappointed his base, whether it's student debt, whether it's on climate, whether it's on Gaza, the argument that was made back in 2020, I'm so much better than the alternative, I'm restoring normalcy, I'm getting the ugliness out of politics, doesn't land so well when you are erasing those divisions through your language. And I will say this, the best case scenario, I agree that walking it back is cringe because you end up in a place where you've made everybody angry. The best case scenario is for him not to have said it in the first place. But this, I think, gets to the bigger problem of Joe Biden, during the State of the Union, was visibly flustered and thrown off when there were interjections from the audience. That's the opposite of what happened back last year when he actually had one of his best, most cogent, on his toes moment when he was going back and forth with a Republican in the audience. This time, it seemed like he was not actually quick on his feet, and it highlighted this bigger issue, which is his mental competence and age.
Mm. Yeah, I'm not ready to let the illegal immigrant argument go. I think it's the most common way people refer to it. It wasn't until recently considered offensive by some. I'm looking up the legal terms in U.S. immigration law. They use illegal alien, unauthorized alien, undocumented alien, illegal immigrant. Like, it's not consistent in the documentation. I support making it easier to immigrate to the country. I don't agree. And there's also something funny about, you know, Biden having many of the same policies and, in fact, trying to get very right-wing policies. Not right-wing enough for many on the right, which is why they voted against them. But say, you know, the word choice, the phraseology is the problem rather than the underlying policy. Alex Narasta at the Cato Institute, who is very, very much on the wants more immigration, you know, is usually put up on TV as like a foil to people who are hawkish on the border, says that he thinks this entire debate over what term to use is a complete distraction and we should focus on the policy, not that most people think of the term as illegal immigrant and you're trying to like...
Yeah, well, I agree with that, obviously. Yeah. But we're, I mean, it's something that we're having a conversation about the language. I would also say this. It's not that he called this man an illegal immigrant. That's one level of, okay, you're right. A lot of people interchangeably use illegal immigrant. Even, frankly, I found myself doing an immigration episode recently where, you know, there was no other way to describe someone, you know, we were talking about a situation where an American was deciding whether or not to help someone who was had clearly just done an illegal border crossing. And I don't know how else you describe that other than the implications for the American only attached because the guy had broken the law. And we were talking about a legal situation. That being said, an illegal is different. That's like when people start to say a black. You know that there's a different kind of a, you know, implication to that sort of a thing. So I think that it's not just that he, if he had just said an illegal immigrant, I think most people would have let it go. It felt like a more pointed kind of othering that whatever you think about it and whatever the right thing's about it, his core base, and again, not the left, who's frustrated with him for a whole host of reasons, but his core base was really deeply frustrated because it feels to them, I think, like the rug has been pulled up out from under them because the whole point of getting on board with a Biden project, a generic Democrat, that's who Biden was in 2020, was that a generic Democrat at least knew how to talk about immigrants in a way that didn't feel like it was sympathetic to the kind of messaging that comes from the right.
And I don't know. I would like, okay, that's fine. I would like to see some polling on how even Democrats feel about this term. I was trying to find some and I couldn't pull it up. I would be interested to know more about exactly which Democrats were put off by this. It might be the case. But anyway, it does feel like an unnecessary, yet he could have just used the term, if he didn't want to offend people, he should have just used the term, whatever he wanted, or written, you know, just gotten around it somehow, just done that.
Well, let's also make sure we understand the context. The context was that I think it was Marjorie Taylor Greene had shouted about the young woman
right.
whose family was in attendance, and they were passing out buttons with her name on it.
And he had one.
And he had one. Marjorie Taylor Greene had given him one right. when he was coming into the room. And so he was attempting to basically validate in some ways Republicans in the audience's concerns and the family's concerns about obviously having dealt with the tragedy of their daughter having been killed. So the irony is that he was trying to throw a bone to Republicans.
Yes. Well, and not to Republicans.
You're right. To everybody right. who I think understands that this is a horrible tragedy. The question is whether or not Biden's immigration policy or any immigration policy whatsoever can be blamed for that particular tragedy. And moreover, whether or not using emphasizing that particular tragedy cast a pall on the true statistics about undocumented immigrants and their crime rates, which is that they are Americans are twice as likely to commit a crime as undocumented immigrants are. And does something about the way this is being framed obscure that reality? I think those are the concerns that are being managed here. And Biden just completely stepped in it, which again is this question. Can he get through a whole campaign season if in one little colloquy with Republicans in a pretty sterile environment throws him off his game so much that one of the most covered stories out of the State of the Union is him having to go on this apology tour, which I think you're right. Just it's gonna make everybody upset.
Everybody's upset. That's the story of Biden's 2024 campaign so far. We'll have more Rising right after this.
Politics and global events certainly made themselves known at Hollywood's big event last night. At the Oscars last night, there were red pins worn inside and protests out front to show support for Palestinians in the midst of their humanitarian crisis. But most notably, or at least most virally, the winner of the International Feature Award for Zone of Interest, Jonathan Glazer, made waves by offering support for Palestine in his acceptance remarks. In his speech, Glazer told the audience, quote, "Our film shows where dehumanization leads at its worst. It shaped all of our past and present. Right now, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people, whether the victims of the October 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack in Gaza, all the victims of this dehumanization." Now, writer and director Jonathan Glazer's movie focuses on the family life of Rudolf Höss, commandant of the Auschwitz concentration camp in Nazi-occupied Poland during World War II. So this went super viral for a couple of reasons. One, it was pretty shocking and a less kind of caveated statement than the kinds of statements you often see in these kinds of speeches. And it was coming from Jewish directors of a movie that was about the Holocaust and sort of the banality of evil. And so if anything, it seemed like there was a real kind of simpatico, real grist to make a comparison. But in fact, there was a lot of backlash from people who sort of abbreviated, truncated the statement to make it sound like they were saying, I'm revoking my Jewishness, as opposed to saying that they're criticizing their Jewishness being co-opted into political objectives that they don't agree with.
Sure. Yes, I saw a lot of frustration with that statement, or likening what is going on in Gaza right now to what happened in the Holocaust, the deliberate and intentional extermination of 6 million Jewish people. What is going on in Gaza is, of course, very, very awful and very sad, and I hope it comes to an end as soon as humanly possible. I saw many people objecting to the now and people dying in the course of a war against a terrorist group, different than the deliberate and planned extermination of the Jews in Europe. I saw a lot of people upset about, using it for that, using his pedestal to make that statement. But of course, that is his right to do that, and people have. Making the Oscars political is obviously nothing new and happens in every other acceptance speech, it seems to me. So was not surprised to see that happen.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I what's interesting to me is, as a person who's not Jewish, I'm not interested in speaking for what any Jewish person thinks or does not think about this. But it is interesting that they are people who are specifically saying that our film talks about shows where dehumanization leads. Like, that's the analogy. To say that it has to be a one-to-one comparison, obviously, in scale alone, that would be a ridiculous thing to say. But the point they're trying to make, I think, pretty clearly is the film shows where dehumanization leads. It shaped all of our past and present. And talking about both the victims of October 7th and the ongoing victims of the siege as people who are bearing the burden and the consequences of dehumanizing our fellow man. And I think notably, the fact that in order to make a case against that statement, it did seem like there was an effort to, frankly, lie about what it said, suggests to me that it really was a powerful one, that the only way to really argue with it for a lot of people did seem to be to misrepresent it. Variety has since offered a correction, but it initially characterized, truncated the statement so that it made it sound like they were revoking their Jewishness, period. And there were a lot of cultural commentators who weighed in with that abbreviated quote instead of just contending with what it said on its face, regardless of whether or not you think that comparison is appropriate. Well, the Ukrainian director who won for the Academy Award for the Best Documentary Feature, 20 Days in Mariupol, also made a statement of a political nature saying, quote, I will be the first director on this stage who will say, I wish I had never made this film. I wish to be able to exchange this to Russia, never attacking Ukraine, never occupying our cities. I wish to give all the recognition to Russia not killing tens of thousands of my fellow Ukrainians. I wish for them to release all the hostages, all the soldiers who are protecting their lands, all the civilians who are now in their jails. Along with the dazzling red carpet looks, many attendees, including Billie Eilish, Mark Ruffalo, and Ava DuVernay, wore red pins representing artists for ceasefire. A group of 400 celebrities joined a campaign in late October, published a letter urging the U.S. Congress and President Joe Biden to call for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and Israel. A press statement, Artist for Ceasefire said, quote, the pin symbolizes collective support for an immediate and permanent ceasefire, the release of all the hostages, and for the urgent delivery of humanitarian aid to civilians in Gaza.
There was also a bit of commotion between the show host Jimmy Kimmel and former President Donald Trump, a frequent target of Kimmel and vice versa. Earlier, Trump, in a post on Truth Social, said, has there ever been a worse host than Jimmy Kimmel at the Oscars? His opening was that of a less-than-average person trying too hard to be something which he is not and never can be. Get rid of Kimmel and perhaps replace him with another washed-up but cheap ABC talent, George Slopinopoulos. Interesting. Trump continued, maybe that way their audience and TV ratings will come back from the depths, make America great again. Then right before the Best Picture winner was going to be announced, Kimmel pulled out his phone, read Trump's remarks aloud to the audience and said, quote, I'm really proud of something and I was wondering if I could share it with you. I just got a review. Thank you, President Trump. Thank you for watching. I'm surprised you're still up. Isn't it past your jail time? Which I think is just a reminder of how much this is a Batman-Joker type relationship, the Trump and both the liberal media commentariat and Hollywood celebrities. They feed off each other. Mm-hmm. They both love it. They both get something out of it. Trump, you know, is more obsessed with Rosie O'Donnell than any number of public policies, proposals. I think he would freely admit to that, frankly, if asked. And then the celebrity people love to treat him like, you know, Hitler come again, and everyone wins by being righteously indignated, and everybody's respective viewers and supporters get to hate on each other, and it's this silly spectacle that doesn't get us any closer to solving our problems as a society.
Yeah, look, it was Trump's
and
tweet.
And yes, I just made up the word indignated.
Look, if Trump can do it, you can do it, Robbie. I believe in you. I support you. Look, the Trump tweet came out and was kind of circulating on Twitter while the Oscars was ongoing. And so the fact that Kimmel was able to kind of pick up on that and read it into the Oscars as they were happening did feel like a kind of fresh on the fly moment, the sort of which you hope happens at an Oscars. And I will say overall, I thought some formatting changes, guest choices, production choices made it a really enjoyable, one of the more delightful, enjoyable, engaging, personal Oscars I've watched in a really long time. And this felt like a good sort of production choice outside of the politics of it. But I think you're completely right about the Batman and Robin aspect of this. When you saw Trump, Batman and Joker, sorry.
Robert, you're introducing some other themes. This is a family show, so we won't get into that.
Robbie, I just went that there's a two-party duopoly. But yeah, like I do agree that this is like that aspect of it is completely predictable. The reason that Trump's tweet went viral on Twitter, even though he's not even on Twitter, is because he knows how to entertain. He knows how to be funny. He always tweets negatively about the Oscars. It's become an American tradition. And Kimmel is there to bat it right back at him.
And that is why Donald Trump is going to be president.
100%. I would place my bets assuming that's going to be the outcome.
I was happy to see Oppenheimer get all the support it deserves. Mm-hmm. It is a tremendous film. Christopher Nolan is an amazing director. Oppenheimer is not my favorite film by him. A lot of other films I liked better, but I was glad to see him get his due. And of course, Cillian Murphy, who is fantastic. So
yeah,
I was happy. There were some other good films nominated too, to be clear, but
I enjoyed the movie. I didn't have a problem with that per se. For me, the biggest upset was how many awards Poor Things received. Mm. I didn't dislike the movie, but I just was so unimpressed by it. And there were so many strong movies in various categories. I was really hoping that Best Supporting Actress would go to Killers of the Flower Moon. The actress from the lead from Zone of Interest, who's also the lead in Anatomy of a Fall, which was amazing. I watched Anatomy of the Fall over the weekend. It was really extraordinary. I didn't get Poor Things outside of like hair and makeup.
I didn't see Poor Things, but my mother, who does not typically like weird movies, gave it a favorable review via text to me. So
I like weird movies. It wasn't the weirdness. I felt it was kind of soulless, didn't exactly know what it wanted to say. I was very glad to see American Fiction get Best Adapted Screenplay. Mm-hmm. Court Jefferson won that. I think it was very richly deserved. So on the whole, good Oscars. I liked it.
All right, that does it for us for today. Tomorrow on Rising, we'll be back with another fantastic edition of our show. Thank you so much for tuning in.
Be sure to like, share, and subscribe so you never miss any content. For those of you who like to listen while you're on the go, we're now available anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Bye-bye.
Take care.